From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the situation in Ukraine, including how Ukraine has sharpened the Washington debate on President Obama's foreign policy. Helping the people of the Central African Republic, plus researchers to test promising therapy for HIV-infected newborns. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russian forces have tightened their grip on Crimea as authorities in the breakaway territory push their plan to join Moscow, while Ukraine's prime minister vowed on Sunday not to give up a single centimeter of territory. Interim Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk addressed the supporters who rallied in Kiev to celebrate the 200th birthday of the Ukrainian poet and national hero Taras Shevchenko. Mr. Yatsenyuk will meet on Wednesday with President Obama. That meeting will take place here in Washington to discuss the standoff over Crimea, a strategic peninsula, as everyone knows, in southern Ukraine with a Russian-speaking majority. Ukrainians have been holding demonstrations outside the Russian embassy in Kiev. They are demanding that Russia withdraw its troops from Crimea. Ina Danchenko was one of the anti-Russian protesters.
I want to say to Mr. Putin that he is a very belligerent guy, but we are invincible nation. And we are invincible because our spiritual power and our soldiers that he besieged in the Crimea island, they will stand for to the very end. And we'll do the same. We'll support everyone who is there now.
Meantime, a Russian lawmaker said the Kremlin had set aside $1.1 billion to rebuild Crimea's industrial infrastructure if the disputed region votes in a March 16th referendum to join Russia. But German Chancellor Angela Merkel told Russian President Vladimir Putin in a phone call on Sunday the planned Moscow-backed referendum was illegal and violated Ukraine's constitution. For some perspective now on Russia's reaction to events in Ukraine, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with two scholars on the region. Matthew Rojansky is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Andrew Cutchins is director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Rojansky was asked for his read on why President Putin sent troops into Crimea.
I think there are several layers of interest here from the Russian side. First and foremost, obviously, is Ukraine. You can't separate the events in Crimea in the last week from the larger story, which is that Ukraine's now had a revolution. It turned out to be a violent revolution. It turned out to be quite a significant change. You had, obviously, President Yanukovych fleeing the country and being replaced by what had before then been the opposition, as opposed to the kind of middle ground constitutional transfer of power that was envisioned in the EU brokered negotiations. Under those circumstances, I think there's a real concern from Moscow that they will have lost their ability to leverage into Ukrainian politics. And so this is a strong signal to the Ukrainians going forward. Hey, look, we need to be taken seriously. We want to continue to be able to effectively veto Ukraine's path in joining the European Association Agreement, potentially in the future joining the EU, certainly joining NATO, which has been a big Russian concern for a long time. There's also a major Russian domestic political factor here, which is that it is absolutely true Russians and Ukrainians are historically close to each other. The two societies read each other's media. They're both very large Eastern Slavic countries. And of course, Putin asserts a kind of leadership over East Slavs, more than just Russians. The Ukrainian church is very important to his image in that respect. And his concern, I think, is, so here you've had a major popular uprising, which has deposed a leader who seemed in many respects to be following Putin's model, a power vertical, agglomerating assets around himself, using authoritarian means, ultimately using violence against the protesters. Well, if they can succeed in Ukraine, then the question that many in Russia have raised is, why not in Russia as well? And I think that's a bridge too far for Putin. He cannot accept that.
Turning to you, Andrew Cutchins, to get your take on what is motivating Vladimir Putin. No question, Ukraine is critical to its identity. It's a country that bridges both the East and the West. I'd like to get your take on the fact that he has gone this far and what else is at stake.
Well, let me put it in a little more colloquial terms, perhaps. Putin is really mad.
Okay. That's an understatement.
He was really mad that the February 21 agreement fell apart.
This was the agreement that the EU and the Russians and
the Americans,
brokered.
The Russians observed, The Russians did not sign on to it, but in retrospect, they've seen that as kind of the status quo they want to get back to, but that's absolutely impossible. Anybody who looked at the February agreement should have understood, though, there was virtually no chance that Ukrainian people would accept it, that Yanukovych could not stay in power for another 10 months until December. You know, I think that Matt nicely laid out some of the motivations behind Mr. Putin, but I think his great miscalculation is that if he does indeed view himself as the leader of the so-called East Slavs, I really don't think that most of the East Slavs outside of the Russian Federation look to Vladimir Putin as their leader. And if there's any silver lining that has emerged out of what's taken place in the last week, is that the Ukrainians living in the East and the Ukrainians living in the South, where there is a higher percentage relatively than in the west of Ukraine, but still a minority ethnic Russian population in Ukraine, they are much more united today than they were a week ago. And in that respect, Putin may very well find himself that, yes, he will have Crimea, whether it's in a kind of a de facto independence like Abkhazia or actually joining the Russian Federation, but he will have aided and abetted, I think, a much deeper antagonism more broadly in Ukraine against Russia. I think it's unfortunate in general because Ukraine is a country with some identity challenges because of the East-West split. It's a little bit too simplistic, but I think that Putin, if his goal was to try to send a signal to Kyiv and the Ukrainian government, I think it was deeply counterproductive for his interests in the long term, but time will tell.
Andrew Kutchins, director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He and Matthew Rodzianski, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, spoke with Carol Castiel. She's host of the VOA program Encounter. For more on their conversation, go to our website, voanews.com, and look for Encounter under podcast. Events in Ukraine have reignited debate here in Washington about President Obama's foreign policy and whether his administration suffers from a fundamental naivete about the goals and motives of America's adversaries. VOA's Michael Bowman has our report.
Pointing to Syria's ongoing civil war bloodbath, Iran's nuclear ambitions, and Russia's intervention in Ukraine, Republican lawmakers have criticized President Obama's leadership on the world stage. Senator Ted Cruz.
A critical reason for Putin's aggression has been President Obama's weakness, that Putin fears no retribution. Their policy has been to alienate and abandon our friends.
Expanding on the critique is House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers.
Up to date, we thought it was a different century, and the administration thought, well, if we just act nice, everyone will act nice with us. And that's just unfortunately not the way that Putin and the Russian Federation sees the rest of the world.
The White House is not deaf to the criticism. Spokesman Jay Carney.
There is an argument out there. Factless, founded on no substantiated basis, that suggests that the president of Russia has taken the action that he's taken because of actions the United States has taken. I think that any historian, anybody knowledgeable about Russia or the former Soviet Union would be as dismissive of that suggestion as I am trying to be now.
President Obama should focus on the immediate situation in Ukraine, according to analyst Michael O'Hanlon.
I don't feel like he should worry, and I don't think he is all that inclined to worry, that this broader cacophony of criticism about his supposedly feckless foreign policy needs to be proven wrong by how we react to Ukraine. The stakes are too high. The potential for doing something really wrong is too high.
O'Hanlon describes the administration's response to Ukraine as fairly robust, but adds stronger measures may be needed.
If Russia were to launch some kind of a general and blatant assault against Ukraine, I think the talk of helping Ukraine's military with various kinds of assistance should be seriously considered.
Russia says it is acting in Crimea to protect Russian nationals from what Moscow considers an illegitimate Ukrainian government. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Police in southern Iraq say a suicide bomber killed at least 42 people, wounded 157 others when he detonated an explosive-filled minibus at a crowded security checkpoint. The Sunday attack set 50 cars on fire, killing those trapped inside as they waited for their vehicles to be searched. The bombing was at the northern entrance to the Shiite-dominated city of Hilla, about 100 kilometers south of Baghdad. There was no claim of responsibility for the attack. Libyan Navy and pro-government militias have dispatched boats to a port held by a rival militia to stop a North Korean-flagged tanker from exporting oil sold without government permission. The government has banned militias from selling crude oil directly to the world market. Edward Uranian is following the story.
Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan repeated an official warning to a North Korean-flagged oil tanker Saturday afternoon to leave Libyan waters or face attack. He says that the North Korean tanker bearing the name Morning Glory entered the Libyan port of Sidra, breaking international law, and was warned to leave or face attack. He stresses that the ship has said it would like to leave, but is being forced by militiamen to load crude. Mr. Zaidan indicated that his government hopes to resolve the crisis as soon as possible, but that a government attack on the ship would create an ecological disaster. He added that orders for the ship to leave were not carried out by the army due to an internal conflict. He says that the Libyan Army Chief of Staff is refusing to accept orders from the Defense Minister or from the government, making it impossible to make the army take action. Reuters news agency reported that militiamen in the port of Sidra had overseen the loading of the North Korean oil tanker. The ship has reportedly been in Libyan territorial waters since Tuesday. Militia leader Ibrahim Jadran in nearby Ajdabiya is reportedly behind the tug of war. Leaders of the eastern separatist region of Barka, who have declared autonomy from Libya's central government several times since 2012, told journalists that they endorse the export of oil, which they claim is a right under a 1951 constitution dividing the country into three regions. Abdrabu al-Barasi, the self-styled prime minister of the Barka region, insisted that his region would continue oil exports and would not accept threats from the central government. He says that his region will not accept any threats with respect to ships or tankers dealing with it. He claims that he is not making any threats and does not want to use force, but that his region is claiming its rights and warns against any attack. Al-Barasi went on to argue that his region was protecting the oil wealth of all Libyans and that it would return 15% of revenues to the central government in accordance with an old arrangement under the regime of King Idris al-Sanusi, who was deposed in 1969. Another separatist official, Sheikh Mabrek al-Lawati, urged Western governments to buy oil from his region. He says that his region has opened the spigots to export oil both from the port of Sidra and from another port in Tobruk, and is urging Western nations like Britain, France, the US, Italy, and Germany to buy this oil. U.S. Ambassador to Libya Deborah Jones tweeted Saturday from a conference on Libya in Istanbul that purchase of oil within Libya from anyone other than government entities amounts to theft from the Libyan people. Libya's acting oil minister Omar Shakmak called the attempt to export oil from Sidra an act of piracy. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Also in the news, United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos is calling for urgent action to prevent further bloodshed in the Central African Republic. She says during a recent trip to the CAR, she was overwhelmed by the level of destruction and climate of fear. She says the state has no institutions that can deliver basic services and has no capacity to stop the violence.
There was palpable fear in the eyes of the people that we met in Bangui and also in Bosangoa, and lots of people saying that they wanted to leave the country.
Latest estimates put the number of internally displaced at 650,000, nearly 300,000 have fled to Cameroon, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Republic of Congo. Amos warns of the looming food crisis in the CAR as well and says money is needed to position food before the rains come and the roads become impassable.
Then you have IDP sites like the site at the airport with 70,000 refugees. I talked about the possibility of disease outbreaks. We haven't had them so far. With 70,000 people in an IDP site that just gets overrun with rain. The shelter is extremely poor. It will be absolutely terrible, and we will see this repeated across the country. And I have no doubt that if we don't get these resources and do more, then people will die.
The UN Emergency Relief Coordinator also told VOA the lack of security throughout the CAR is a huge problem for civilians and for humanitarian workers trying to reach them with essential aid. The UN Refugee Agency is warning that tens of thousands of Sudanese refugees in neighboring South Sudan are facing a severe food shortage. Lisa Schlein reports now from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency is helping to care for 130,000 refugees from Sudan's embattled Blue Nile state. They are living across the border in South Sudan in camps in Maban County of Upper Nile state. Maban County is not directly affected by the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, but UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says insecurity and border restrictions along supply corridors have prevented the delivery of relief items since the beginning of the year. He tells VOA it is urgent to get food into the refugee camps before the onset of the rains, which will render roads impassable.
It has been impossible to get food pre-positioned there because of the insecurity we've seen, and this now is starting to show itself in some very worrying consequences. Real shortages of food, glowing rates of global and severe acute malnutrition. We are particularly worried the impact this may have on people who, as they move, because if you move across from there towards Ethiopia, for example, the conditions are difficult, the route is difficult. It is likely that people arriving in Ethiopia, should they come there, will be in a much worse state still.
Edward says about one-third of the refugee population is at greatest risk. It includes children under five, pregnant and lactating women, elderly, the disabled, and those who are chronically ill. He notes the rains normally start in April and warns that waterborne diseases, malaria, and respiratory tract infections will increase.
In recent weeks, we have seen several cases of kwashiorkor among very young children in the refugee camps. Kwashiorkor is a form of severe malnutrition to do with protein deficiencies. Food shortages could lead to conflict, too, between refugees and host communities foraging for wild fruits and vegetables. Already, we have seen tension over grazing lands, over access to open water sources.
The World Food Program has been providing normal food rations for the refugee camps, but the agency says the crisis in South Sudan is making it extremely difficult to access this region and resupply the camps. Because normal supply routes are disrupted, WFP says it will be using a combination of airlifts and airdrops to replenish the stocks in Maban County. An estimated 739,000 people in South Sudan have become internally displaced since fighting erupted in mid-December. The World Food Program so far has provided food to more than 420,000 conflict-affected people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
U.S. officials have announced the funding of an international medical trial to see whether aggressively treating HIV-infected newborns with antiretroviral drugs cures them. The news follows the announcement this week that a year-old infant in the U.S. state of California born with the AIDS virus shows no signs of infection after aggressive antiretroviral therapy. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
There are now two documented cases in the United States of newborns who contracted HIV in the womb going into remission following the immediate start of aggressive antiretroviral therapy. In both instances, the HIV-positive mothers were not in therapy at the time of delivery. In the case of the so-called Mississippi baby reported a year ago, doctors began giving the infant a three-drug combination of anti-AIDS drugs 30 hours after birth. Sensitive tests showed the virus had reached undetectable levels within a month. The baby took the drugs for a year and a half until doctors lost track of her. When the infant resurfaced, she had not been on therapy for 10 months, but tests continued to show no signs of the virus. Doctors say the infant, who has not taken any HIV medications now for 2 years, remains healthy. In the latest case, physicians in Long Beach, California, began a cocktail of HIV drugs within 4 hours after birth. Almost a year later, they could detect no virus in the infant.
Now, that doesn't mean that the baby is cured or that the virus is not there, but it's strongly suggestive of that.
Anthony Fauci is director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and a leading researcher in the fight against AIDS.
They have not discontinued therapy in the baby, and so they have not proven that the baby is cured, as was the case with the Mississippi baby.
Fauci says a large international trial will get underway in about a month to see whether HIV-infected newborns can be cured with this sort of early aggressive treatment.
So hopefully we'll get the answer to the question of whether this is an applicable, reproducible phenomenon.
Fauci says newborns who become infected with HIV in utero will begin antiretroviral therapy within 48 hours of birth. They will be followed to see if the virus disappears, and in select cases, some infants may eventually be weaned from drugs. He notes that mother-to-child transmission of the AIDS virus is rare in the United States. Most of the estimated 250,000 babies born infected to HIV-positive mothers every year live in developing countries, where the first time many untreated women show up to a clinic is to deliver their babies. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
William Clay Ford Sr., the last surviving grandchild of Ford Motor Company founder Henry Ford, has died. He was the father of William Clay Ford Jr., currently the executive chairman of the automaker. Elder Ford died of pneumonia at his suburban Detroit, Michigan home on Sunday. He was 88. Ford joined the automaker's sales and advertising staff after graduating from Yale University in 1949. He was elected to the company's board of directors the year before he graduated and served until his retirement in 2005, more than half the automaker's 110-year history. He's survived by his wife of 66 years, Martha Firestone Ford, the granddaughter of Harvey Firestone, the founder of the Firestone Tire Company. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the latest world news is coming your way shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aydin Utku, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On March 10th, 241 BC, the first of three conflicts between Rome and Carthage was decided in a naval battle off the west coast of Sicily. The Roman fleet scored a victory, leading to a Carthaginian surrender in the first of the so-called Punic Wars. On this date in 1804, the American flag was raised on day two of the Three Flags ceremony in St. Louis. This happened after the French and Spanish flags had been lowered. The ceremony marked the turning over of the Louisiana Purchase, more than 2 million square kilometers of territory, to the United States. In 1831, the French Foreign Legion was created. The Legion was an all-volunteer force that once attracted mostly foreigners, troublemakers, and outcasts. Commanded by French officers, the Legion has seen combat in regional and world wars. In 1848, the U.S. Senate ratified the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, ending the three-year war between the United States and Mexico. With the defeat of its army and the fall of its capital, Mexico ceded territory, now covering some or all of the U.S. states of Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. In 1906, Europe's worst mining accident occurred in northern France. A coal dust explosion took the lives of more than 1,000 men. On this day in 1910, slavery was officially abolished in China. On this day in 1913, abolitionist Harriet Tubman died. Over the course of 10 years, Tubman, a runaway slave, would lead hundreds of other slaves to freedom along the so-called Underground Railroad, a secret network of safe houses. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many countries around the world, journalists intent on telling the truth about repression, corruption, and criminality must risk their liberty and their lives to do so. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 2013 was the second worst year on record for journalists, with 211 imprisoned and more than 100 killed. In a memorial speech in honor of slain American journalist Daniel Pearl, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power underscored the critical importance the United States places on a free media and the duty of governments to ensure access to information, in part, crucially, so that governments can be held accountable to their citizens. But, as Ambassador Power pointed out, many governments try to corrupt, intimidate, and manipulate the press. Their methods include bribery, parceling out licenses to friends or others willing to practice self-censorship, imposing strict limitations on the internet and social networks, hiring intermediaries to harass and attack reporters and editors, and enacting laws that equate criticism of the government with subversion, terrorism, or treason. Ambassador Power cited several examples, including the case of Chinese reporter Liu Hu, who was arrested in September for defamation after urging authorities to investigate a local official, the arrest of Al Jazeera correspondents in Egypt, and the case of Ethiopian journalist Eskinder Nega, who continued to work online after his newspaper was closed and was arrested and imprisoned in 2011 for protesting the arrest of other journalists under a sweeping new law. From Eritrea and Iran to Ukraine and Venezuela, there are many comparable stories, said Ambassador Power. But, she noted, as Thomas Jefferson affirmed 225 years ago, freedom of the press is the best means of ensuring that all avenues of truth are open to individual citizens, and the United States has made support for press freedom one of the core and recurring themes of U.S. diplomacy. Each day, in ways public and private, U.S. officials make known our backing for the right of people to speak, publish, broadcast, blog, tweet, and otherwise express themselves openly and without fear, said Ambassador Power. After all, she stressed, defending freedom of the press is but one element of a larger struggle, a duty to be advocates for the rights and dignity of every human being.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.